as David said, now for something completely different. And we yes. move from very legal issues towards a much more empirical set of perspectives on the EEAS and to do with issues of recruitment, training and staff perception. So we're going down amongst the weeds. My name is Chris Shaw. It's a great pleasure and honour to be here. Thank you, David. I'm a social anthropologist at the University of Auckland. And on our panel, we have two speakers, Dr. Karolina Pomorska from the University of Cambridge, but who's actually from the Maastricht on secondment for a year, I believe, and Dr. Simon Duke, who is based at the European Institute of Public Administration, also in Maastricht. And so without further ado, let me pass you on, first of all, to Karolina.
Thank you very much. I am presenting a paper. I'm presenting a paper co-written with Anna Hunkos from University of Bristol, who unfortunately couldn't come today. And in our paper, we focus on the notion of esprit de corps and its potential emergence in the European External Action Service. We believe that this subject was worth looking at for several reasons. First of all, scholars and practitioners have said that fostering esprit de corps in the newly established EAS is very important, and they pointed out this need, and many of them are here today in this room. Secondly, in our previous study of attitudes in the External Action Service, we found out that while the officials held very positive attitudes towards the service and the EAS itself, they acknowledged the fact that not enough had been done to promote esprit de corps. And I might also mention this study we did on the attitudes and perceptions, I just might mention now that an overwhelming majority of officials from EAS, from all three sort of pools, had very favorable view about the need of the service in general, the EAS. All of them but one, however, said that the creation of EAS had negative impact on their careers. So that was also quite interesting. Third, fostering esprit de corps is particularly relevant in the case of EAS because it's undergoing the process of organizational change and merger. And this by itself is an extremely difficult time for any organization. So I think the literature is clear that a lot of attention needs to be given towards the staff. And finally, the theory says, well, that esprit de corps, at least in theory, is beneficial to the organization as it increases its effectiveness and coherence. And Cesar talked yesterday about the importance of coherence. You hear a lot of officials, Catherine Ashton, talking about coherence. So it should increase coherence and means also that the staff is more satisfied and less prone to leave. Now, we have gone through the academic literature on the European Union and European foreign policy to see what has been written on esprit de corps. And the concept comes up quite a lot. Again, some people are also here. But what we found out that it is used without sort of much rigor. There is a little bit of a chaos. So people refer to esprit de corps in very different ways. Some of them use it as to talk about the collegial atmosphere within a group. Others talk about identification with the goals and values of an organization. Others talk about, use it as equivalent of emergent of supranational identities among EU and national officials. And these are sort of similar, but at the same time, very different ways in which esprit de corps has been used. So while some decided, oh, there is emergence, it's in the undergoing, some others have had different conclusions, and we just questioned that, can you have common conclusion without common understanding what it really is. So in our paper, we try to provide a clear definition of esprit de corps, provide its categories, and then analyze the five factors that shape esprit de corps in the EAS. I obviously cannot discuss all of that here, but I will just briefly mention, and then if you're interested in anything, we can discuss more in the question and answer session. I can tell you more about our study in Brussels. So what is esprit de corps? In the search for an answer, we looked into the literature in the field of organizational studies, sort of business management. We thought they've been working on it for quite a while. And we found a definition that it is an individual level phenomena resulting from one's interaction in a group with other individuals that consists of feelings and beliefs the individual holds about the group. Esprit de corps has been also defined more simply as the extent to which there is evidence of a team spirit within organization. I will not go too much into theory here. I just promised to Anna that I would mention that we encounter three different types of esprit de corps, organizational one, professional one, and workgroup esprit de corps. I will refer to organizational one, which is understood as the degree to which an individual believes his organization performs an important function and offers unique opportunities for growth and reward. Now, having this clarified, I want to move to our analysis. We found in the literature that there are four factors generally believed to influence esprit de corps, and these are leadership, communication, trust, and public image. To this four, we also added training, because I think that has been very present in the debate about the EAS recently. Now, our data comes from 41 semi-structured interviews with EAS officials on various levels, from speeches and secondary sources. But the study is still ongoing. I'm about to go to Brussels again, so I would welcome any feedback from your side. And to start off, I would like to talk about leadership. It is a common assumption in the literature that good leaders play a crucial role in facilitating esprit de corps and are very important also in times of crisis, mainly because they are meant to reduce insecurity among staff. Ideally, they should make the responsibilities clear to the employees and keep them very well informed on the progress that the organization makes towards achieving its ends. They also have a very crucial role in developing and communicating organizational norms and goals. So overall, it is expected that the more positive the perceptions of the leader's performers, the higher esprit de corps. Now, in the EAS, this leadership should come from the high representative, Catherine Ashton, with the help from the corporate board. Initially, the process of creating EAS moved at a very slow pace, as we all know, and that resulted in a lot of frustration at different levels of staff. The creation of a collaborative culture was very soon identified as an important task when you look at the speeches of officials. Also, O'Sullivan, the chief operating officer, was claiming that the first step in creating a common culture is implementing our provisional organizational structure. Very soon, all staff will work together under one chain of command, which will create a common sense of purpose. What we found here, that while this shows that the challenges were very well recognized, well, the belief that just working under one chain of command will create this common sense of purpose maybe was a little bit unfounded. It didn't take very long until very critical voices appeared both in the media and inside the service regarding the leadership. Especially we found in our study that Council Secretariat officials were very nostalgic about the times under Javier Solana's leadership in Council Secretariat General. One prominent academic recently wrote that Ashton had elected to define her position as that rather of a secretary than a leader. We thought, well, maybe that had an influence on the internal leadership as well. There is a positive point. Some colleagues thought from the EAS that Lady Ashton was a strong chairwoman at tense meetings with some personal charm. But still, overall, the officials mentioned that the organization had rather too many leaders and not enough strategic leadership. And here many metaphors were used in our interviews, and I think the expression of EAS being a Mexican army, which at first I didn't understand what it meant, I think it now entered Brussels jargon very much. So it means too many generals and not enough soldiers. I think one official very neatly summed up the feelings that was shared by many officials. He said, the implementation is not meeting our expectations. This is because there is a very weak leadership. The impression one gets is that there is a huge organization without a head. In the Commission, he was coming from the Commission. In the Commission, your role was clearly defined, as well as the instruments with how to do your work. There is a large lack of strategic vision about where we are going. And here on the strategic leadership more generally, several officials referred to the fact that there was too much bureaucracy, service was too heavy in procedures and in process. Some officials from CSDP structures, from EUMS, complained that it was very difficult to reach the highest levels in organization. That might have well been because there were different priorities, overwhelmed staff, but we are not here discussing the reasons, just telling you what were the perceptions that we found out among the staff in the EAS. Also, when they compared to their national ministries of foreign affairs, those that were seconded, they said, well, there is still the lack of a clear chain of command in the service. As mentioned earlier, the important component of effective leadership is to provide the staff with the goals and norms that should guide their work. What we found out is that Well, apparently these norms and values, they were not clearly spelled out and introduced to the staff. So, for example, European security strategy has not been updated, talking about sort of very high level of European foreign policy and where it is going. And there is, at least according to our knowledge of our interviewees, there is no mission statement. A couple of years ago, we did work on the Council Secretariat General staff of Javier Solana, and we know they had such mission statement and they had values that should guide the work and so on. So the officials mentioned there was still lack of sense of direction. And Robert Cooper talked yesterday also about the necessity of developing such a common purpose among staff. So not going too much more into this factor, there is a picture that emerges of not enough strong internal leadership. I want to mention I'm talking about internal leadership of the High Representative. There is also, of course, another external dimension. The second factor is communication. So the ability of organization to communicate goals, ideas, and achievements very clearly is a key factor facilitating esprit de corps, according to the literature. It is crucial in socializing newcomers to values and norms of the organization, and that in turn is linked to greater likelihood of job satisfaction, organizational commitment. So, in general, it is expected that the more an employee perceives that the communication is open in an organization, again, the higher will be the esprit de corps. Other important factors, the communication should be rather to flow. And when it comes to merger organizational change, the literature says you have to start very early, before the merger, the change happens. You have to explain very clearly to staff what is happening if you don't want them to, you know, to go into this very tough time totally lost. Now, internal communication with staff regarding emergence of VIS was uneasy from the start. And admittedly, this was largely due to external circumstances. So we had the Irish referendum that was discussed already yesterday. So there was no open public debate and officials couldn't speculate on this matter. And secondly, once there was a green light to go ahead, the project was very elite-driven and highly politicized. Some officials, they told us they were left out in the dark and they said that institutions on purpose kept it very confidential, which is on one hand understandable. You have a merger. Very often a lot of this is kept confidential, even though in the business literature, again, they clearly identify what kind of information should be given to staff and what is reasonable to keep in the dark. So there is also this distinction there. We talked to many officials, as I said, they were positive about the service, but they more or less agreed that this, how the EAS was created and the months that followed was a clear example of how not to communicate with staff. And this communication chaos was summarized by an official who told us, I don't know what's going on, I know nothing. No one told us what the rules are. And I think, while a lot of things are understandable, this expression, I don't know what the rules are here, I don't know how to play this game, that didn't do any favors in the process of creating esprit de corps. Also, the communication over the transfer of staff was very formal to our knowledge, what we have been shown, not what we have heard. The literature would tell you the informal communication is very important. It has to be institutionalized, but to some extent also informal. And here the feedback has been quite overwhelming from the former commission officials. And many of them spent, large part of their lives in the commission, and they sort of expected something maybe more cordial from the commission, cordial farewell, whereas what they received was very... very formal, one email. Apparently later on that was followed by some other messages from Barroso, but they said, that is really late and we do not feel as valued as we would like to. So again, that was not the best start in the new organization. But similar stories also came from other parts of the service, such as EUMS, who also said there was lack of transparency and communication. Again, we can discuss more of that later on. The third factor is public image. So this refers to the fact how employees perceive what is their image outside, so how the outsiders see their organization. And I think this has also been largely discussed here and also yesterday, that the expectations towards EAS performance were very high, and the general conclusion nowadays is that they have not been met, so that has damaged to a large extent the public image of the EAS. A lot of this were the teething problems, but even acknowledging this, the performance of the EAS was quite criticized, for example, during the Libyan crisis. On the other hand, even when they were successes, some people pointed out to the inability of the service to communicate these achievements well to the public. So again, some shortcomings in terms of public diplomacy. And to quote David Spence, he just left, but he summarized very well the state of affairs when he said, "The EAS has had a very difficult start, with disaffection rife in the ranks and skepticism and cynicism as the leitmotifs of most external comment." So again, without saying why that has been the case, it has happened like that. And quite a few officials that we have talked to, they felt that. They would say, well, it is even more difficult because of all this pressure, external pressure, and the perception of what actually we are doing here. The fourth factor is a mutual trust among the officials themselves. Trust facilitates information sharing, cooperation, and risk-taking within organization. Trust, of course, will be stronger once you have an element of reciprocity over time. What I find interesting is that in the study of private companies, it has been shown that once the organization has lost faith and goodwill of employees, it is really an uphill battle to regain this trust. So once you sort of did something not that well with the merger, it is very difficult to regain the trust. I see I'm running out of time, so I will be very brief. Here in the paper, we refer to the issue of institutional loyalties. So we talked with the officials a lot about, you know, do you trust your colleagues from different institutions? What they said was that there is obviously your institutional origin matters a lot, and they were fierce, especially about this idea of the rotation, that the diplomats from the member states would come just for 4 years. Some officials said, well, some capitals are lobbying extremely heavily for some high positions. Obviously, that will have consequences later on, you know, who will be their masters in the service. Some officials talked about the work group as esprit de corps. So there is something there. For example, it's CITSEN in EUMS, EU military staff, but they couldn't see it emerging at the organizational level. About training, which is the fifth factor, I will not talk because we have an excellent expert here. We quote in our paper Simon Duke. I just might mention that for training to have a positive impact on esprit de corps, it must be focused on the team rather than on the individual. From the officials we talked to, I just want to mention that none of them had undergone any form of sort of content training in the EAS beyond attending the IT training and other logistic health and safety training. It might have been because we were heavily biased towards headquarters. So I know that officials going to delegations, they are undergoing different type of training. I will move to conclusion, and I just want to say that our analysis has shown that there has been a problem in the way that esprit de corps was promoted in the EAS. It is often said that it's just a matter of time, so it will emerge. But I think what we got from the theoretical literature is that with challenges such as organizational mergers, changes, the role of leadership and management is crucial, and it should be active in pursuing this promotion of esprit de corps. In spite of that, the conclusion is that on all five factors, so leadership, communication, public image, mutual trust, and training, the EAS does not score very well. It is understandable that many of this is because of some external factors or prioritization of tasks. So there were other priorities at hand. But nonetheless, this is the outcome we had.
Thank you. Thank you, Carolina. Well, yes, should the EU be more proactive, or is it just a matter of time? For a slightly different perspective, and I believe the word crisis of identity is going to feature, let me pass on now to Simon.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you to the organisers for inviting me here. It's a great pleasure to be here with so many colleagues and friends. I'm going to build upon what Carolina has said, and I'm going to try and focus on two specific aspects of the service and what I suspect will be important components in the forthcoming review, namely the issue of gender and geographical balance, and as Carolina has already said, training. Let me just start, though, by making a few general remarks by way of context. Most of these have already been covered by other speakers and questions from the floor, so I will be somewhat telegraphic about this. I think as we focus upon the review, it's important not to forget another wider crisis. Indeed, since we are many academics in the room, I believe you have to mention the word existential in each presentation, so here's my contribution. I think there is an existential crisis about the general role of the EU in the world. What is its fundamental mission? What's its role? And this is in part a shortage of an overarching strategic perspective on the part of the External Action Service. Ironically, the service is drowning in strategies, but doesn't have a strategy. It has 134 country strategies, just in case you wanted to know, strategies for almost every continent and numerous thematic strategies. So I leave this point just hanging in the air because I think it does have a bearing on the questions that we're going to be considering. We've mentioned the ambiguities about the status of the service, not an institution, wrestling to find its institutional space in Brussels. I would like to stress the third point, budget neutrality, and I know Brian and others have already raised this, and I think we need to come back to it. Whatever we wish for the External Action Service, there are very tight budgetary constraints, and indeed they are getting tighter by the day, and this is something we have to be cognizant of. And then finally, I want to dwell upon the question of mindsets, and I know Chris doesn't particularly like this term, so maybe we should think in terms of organized organizational culture related to the specific points I'm going to raise. Let me start off with a quote from the Council decision, July 2010, founding the service. And this goes to the first of my major points, the question of balance in the service. If you just read the quote from the decision, you'll see three key words. Merit, what does that mean? There is no overarching definition of how we should understand merit in the appointment of staff, but this is obviously linked to the specific job profile issued by the service as to whether a candidate is qualified for the position or not. Then we have the word adequate, an adequate geographical and gender balance. Well, this is rather subjective. What does this mean? Should we, for instance, have quotas related to the proportion of population, national populations? Well, this idea, believe it or not, was actually discussed in the lead up to the creation of the service. It was proposed by a senior MEP, and I think for good reasons that we can go into later if you want, disposed of. And then the third word to note, again, highly subjective, is the idea of a meaningful presence of nationals from all member states. What we see, though, is very little latitude in the service to actually address these questions of balance. And I think the reason for this is rather obvious. Because of the composition of the service, it has inherited some significant legacy problems with regard to both forms of balance. We also see enormous differences between the member states when it comes to their ability to forward qualified candidates. The presence of very few national embassies in certain parts of the world has already been noted. This means, ipso facto, that the ability of member states to forward adequately qualified candidates for a number of, for example, heads of delegation posts in substantial parts of the world is inherently limited, and that is going to reflect upon questions of geographical balance. Although it's important to note that symbolically, tremendous effort has been made by the High Representative, who ultimately is responsible for appointments at this level, to ensure that all are represented, and this is the case at the moment, bar Cyprus. And I have no doubt that fairly soon, in the next rotation maybe, Cyprus will be rewarded for its patience. Gender balance is a slightly different question, as I hope I can illustrate in a moment. And there I think there are fewer excuses for the situation that exists in the service. Now, I apologize for data. It's a little small. I hope you can, most of you can see it, but at least you're getting the data before lunch. So, This attempts to show two things. Firstly, if you look at the figures on the right of the screen, you will see that the External Action Service is almost at the one-third representation of temporary assigned national diplomats. Whether it reaches this figure by June of next year, I think, is debatable, although if we break down the figures, we can see there are actually more than a third in the delegations and less than that figure in the headquarters, giving us a cumulative figure of 26.9%. So, you know, it's not far from the ballpark. Now, if we look at the number of diplomats represented in the service, looking at the left-hand column, we can see, I don't think this is a shock to any of us, that the larger, older member states tend to be rather heavily represented. And in particular, I draw your attention to France. The UK is also fairly well represented. And then if we move over to the next column, looking at AD officials, I note actually that these figures, by the way, come from the External Action Service itself, from the staffing report, the latest one, of June this year that I know some of you have seen. It's interesting, though, that... Oh, sorry, I should have explained. Good question. They are administrative officials, AD, the senior levels, and I am not talking here, thank you for that clarification, about AST, the assistant grades. And these are the one that politically people tend to focus upon. If we look at the AD officials, broken down by country, and I notice that it's interesting the External Action Service does this, looks at it this way, we can see, once again, the very heavy representation of French national officials, ditto Germany, Italy, and if we go down to the bottom, Spain as well. So we see similar patterns here. This is part of the legacy problem. Most of the AD officials were obviously transferred en bulk from RELECS, DEV, fewer numbers, and the council itself. Turning to gender very briefly, again, I think there are a few surprises here, partly because of the legacy issue once again. We're talking here about the number of men and women in the headquarters and the delegations, and they pose distinct issues, I think. Women tend to be underrepresented, especially at the higher grades. If you look at AD 12 and up, you see far lower numbers of women compared to males in both the headquarters and the delegations. If you go down to the lower levels, say AD 5 to 7, you'll see closer representation. And if you look at the data for AST officials, not on this chart, then you'll see actually the reverse. You tend to see more women in the lower assistant grades. And this is more or less the same pattern across the commission DGs, with one or two exceptions as well. About first secretary, yes.
And an ambassador would be AD 14?
I think AD 14, 15. Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, first counselor, okay, AD 12, first counselor, yes. I should say this is an interesting point. There is not exact equivalence, and there has been some frustration, again, this is anecdotally, within the service, where officials with many years of service find themselves working with national diplomats at the equivalent grade, but the diplomats sometimes have far fewer years of service. And this, as you can imagine, can create tensions within the service. I'm cognizant of time, so let me just explain why I've highlighted two columns, or rows rather, in red, AD 12 and 13. Why have I done this? Just to illustrate that there is a problem in the service insofar as promotion is concerned. Because of the composition of the service, the initial composition, we have seen high numbers being transferred into the service in these two grades. This means, telegraphically, there is a lot of frustration building up underneath them as people wait for promotion, and this is going to take some time. Quite a few of those stuck in, say, AD 13 grade also cannot advance up to the higher grades because there are very few positions, and they may well be there until retirement. The delegations, we see broadly similar patterns as far as gender goes, but women are even less represented in the delegations, and in part this is because of, I think, obvious practical issues, particularly those relating to spousal employment and family provisions as well. Although I'd note in passing that the staff regulations, Annex 10, have actually made special provisions to try and improve things like parental leave for delegation staff in an effort to try and attract more women to the delegations. Very quickly, the heads of delegation. The reason I'm going to focus upon this is because in the other parts of the External Action Service, there's very little latitude for flexibility to change the essential balance patterns. The only real latitude so far has been in the small number of new appointments to the External Action Service and the three rounds of rotation for the heads of delegation. And this is where Cathy Ashton has made a conscious effort to try, at least symbolically, to improve the balance, both in terms of gender, by appointing 24 women in the rotation so far, and this includes this year's rotation, and to also boost the representation of the newer, that is, post-2004 and 7 members of the EU. Here, I think there is a positive story to tell, but there's inevitably going to be debate about how symbolic these gestures are. But I believe in this particular case that the symbolism is important, and she has taken the mission seriously to try and address these two problems, and indeed in a number of speeches she has said that she is very concerned about these issues. So how might we proceed with a review in mind? Well, we have to bear in mind once again that we have a certain amount of inflexibility, and we are looking in both cases at longer term issues for the service. On gender balance, a number of things can be considered. We could, for instance, think of more sensitivity on the part of the Consultative Committee on Appointments. They are responsible, for those of you who don't know, for all appointments or recommendations to the High Representative for all appointments at director level and above. They also have a more general mandate to oversee these questions of balance and to regularly appraise themselves of developments in these regards. So on gender balance, we could consider mentoring schemes. These don't exist formally at the moment. There are some informal mentoring attempts, including some at very senior level, but I stress they're informal, low-key. We could consider more radical steps, like women-dominant shortlists. I'm not sure that that will win much support internally, but it's worth thinking about. Thinking through the specific problems of the delegations, especially when it comes to spousal employment, maybe coordinating more with the local member state representation to third parties to cross-list career opportunities, employment opportunities, and also to think again about the issue of parental leave, which is a significant impediment for those considering delegation missions. And we could also consider the idea of establishing a specific task force to follow both of these issues more thoroughly. Geographical balance, I think there are slightly different solutions, but one obvious one, and I say this not as a matter of personal interest, would be to put far more emphasis on training and preparation of officials in the member states, and indeed the EEAS could play its part there, to make sure that they are as competitive as possible for positions in the service. Training, very briefly. Now, I'm looking at John Hemery sitting over there, and he probably remembers the halcyon days of the Convention on the Future of Europe, when in 2002 a number of us were in Madrid, and this on the screen is the kind of thing that was being spoken about. This particular quote has enormous aspirations attached to it for training and how we can build up a service, and unfortunately it all went pear-shaped when actually an idea that had been put forward by Senor Galeotti in the European Parliament was taken up and talk started about a European Diplomatic Academy. That then started a highly unhelpful debate, not about the nature of the training, what the program should be, but the obvious question of, is there a European capital of diplomacy, and if so, where is it? So, we got rid of those original plans for an academy. Well, they're still on the books somewhere, but I don't think we're going to see them come back seriously for quite some time. Training as it exists at the moment in the service has made strides. There are some positives to it. We heard a positive story yesterday about the efforts that have been made in regard to political reporting. There's also been emphasis on geopolitics. That, incidentally, is a word that the service themselves like to use. And this means analysis of regions or specific countries, concentrating in particular upon the 10 strategic partners. A term I'm not very comfortable with. 10 strategic partners, really? But anyway, that's another discussion. I think the weak points, though, are the short duration of the induction course. This leaves very little room for any potential socialization effects of the type that Carolina has written about. At the moment, we're talking about 5 days, and that's normally an introduction to the internal procedures, etc. I think there is a slight socialization effect in the kind of training that I run, John, and Brian has also been associated with. But when you've only got people in a room for 2 days, it's certainly not the type of socialization effect that was foreseen in the Convention on the Future of Europe. We also see inadequate coordination between the different potential training bodies. For instance, the European Administrative School is involved, particularly when it comes to the internal dimensions of training, important things like budgetary procedures. There is inadequate coordination with the European Security and Defense College, the ESDC. This is a virtual college, training mainly in the crisis management area, but a lot more could be done to cross-fertilize the kind of training efforts in the service and in the college. And also, training is provided, substantial training is provided by external providers through a framework contract. There is relatively little formal involvement on the part of the member states. And this could be an issue as you go back towards the review and look at the Council decision of 2010. I note there's also a lack of coordination with other parts of external relations. For instance, with DEVCO, trade and enlargement. They have their own training schedules, and this again seems to be highly duplicative and possibly wasteful. Budget and resources, I've already made that point, but let me stress it once again. It is a serious issue and one that I know the training unit in the service are wrestling with. And finally, paradoxically, most of the staff in the External Action Service receive no training. And they're often forgotten about. These are the locally engaged staff in delegations. And the service is cognizant of this. So what they've been trying to do is to look afresh at possible outreach ways of learning, so-called blended learning, combining e-learning and site learning, to try and engage them. These are a few points that are taken from the training strategy. which does exist. It's somewhat vague, though, a little bit disappointing, and I hope this is going to be built upon in the forthcoming review process. I was having a conversation with John Hemery earlier on, and he reminded me that one of the other obvious things missing in the training environment is a comprehensive needs analysis. So the question to the External Action Service would be, do you actually know what you want? And it seemed like a rather obvious idea to undertake this kind of exercise prior to the review. I think the points here I won't go into in detail. They are rather self-obvious. The service itself wishes to create some kind of esprit de corps through training, but I think it has to rethink how it does that if it wants to achieve this end. And I'd note at the end, and maybe here I should invoke Chatham House rules because this is not an official figure, that the budget for training, and this includes language training, internal procedures training, as well as the kind of training that I and others provide, is only around €1 million a year. So we're dealing with very small resources here, and we should be cognizant of that as we think about the review. Sorry, I've run over a bit.
Okay, thank you. Let me just make a few observations and comments on the two papers that we've had. I think both Carolina and Simon's papers deal with kind of issues that go to the very heart of sort of debates in sociology and in anthropology, namely, what is the basis upon which people come to form a sense of common purpose or kind of belonging to the organization for which they work? You know, what are the conditions that might lead individuals towards a sense of shared membership or common interest as a group, a sense of we-ness? And how do you transform a category into a self-identifying group with its own sense of mission? And I'd say I think this is a fundamentally anthropological issue. Why? Well, partly because it brings us into the realm of affect as well as meaning, i.e., you know, that people have to become slightly emotionally engaged with the organization, the institution that employs them, if they are to have that kind of loyalty, the esprit de corps. And in much of the literature, the debate, we often ignore this. We assume that these are really legal, technical processes devoid of human actions and the things that make us human subjects. We're not all rational, calculating, and loyalty and allegiance actually transcends many of those things. It's below the belt as well as above it. In fact, this problem has been alluded to by a number of speakers throughout the last 2 days, and David Spence, in one of his most recent articles, highlighted the problem, I think, quite succinctly, in which he refers to it as the challenge of melding different epistemic communities into one effective new diplomatic community, so that it moves from a diplomatic service am sich to a diplomatic service für sich. I think there are certain problems with that. I'll come on to that in a minute. But so let me begin. Carolina's paper asks the question, and how might the EEAS develop this esprit de corps? And as she points out, to begin with, it's a problematic concept to begin with. There's no consensus. Certainly, I should say that my own research on some of the external delegations in the Asia-Pacific area, which was done before the transition, I certainly picked up a lot of nostalgia and a sense that something that had been created, the strong esprit de corps that existed amongst RELEC staff, had been lost. But that, I say that may be an effect of nostalgia, a period of uncertainty as we were transitioning to something new. But our study also found that that esprit de corps varied, that there's a kind of very different sense of morale and confidence depending on which delegation, external delegation, you look at. It wasn't consistent. But I also concur with Carolina's nice plaintive quote, "No one told us what the rules are." I think there's a sense in which the rules of the game have changed and they haven't yet been, been articulated very clearly. So what else? Well, Carolina gave us 5 key ingredients that are essential in forging this esprit de corps: leadership, communications, and so forth. I would add another 2 to that list, and I think most anthropologists would. And one of them is a shared sense of purpose. I mean, elsewhere we might call this ideology, and I mean that in a positive rather than a negative sense. If you think historically that the periods where the European Commission has been most effective, it always coincides with periods of not only effective leadership, but a really strong sense of elan and mission under Halstein or under Jacques Delors. You know, huge strides were taken, and it was because the institution was fired up by a sense, a really positive sense of that, you know, we were making history, and a very sort of unifying, rallying kind of ethos. But the second issue I draw attention to is the importance of shared symbolism. This was brought up in the last session. I think it's a fairly true statement, and I'm quoting a colleague of mine, a French anthropologist called Marc Abeles, who says that part of the problem with the European project is that it's not so much a democratic deficit as a symbolic deficit. And by symbolism, I mean symbolism in a much wider sense than just sort of logos and the paraphernalia that we see behind us. Everything that we do in the political realm is mediated through symbols. We only come to realize that the entities that we belong to because of their symbolic representation, the state, the nation. You know, we know these because of their symbolic trappings. But I think what's also included in symbolism is a sense of institutional memory, a shared kind of discourse. Put it this way, a common narrative and a sense of shared history is vital for any institution to succeed. Here at the end, I see we have a portrait of Jean Monnet and these flags. This building itself is partly symbolic of that shared history and memory, but the symbolism should not be discounted. And where do we find good examples of it? Well, regrettably, but or not, you see very effective examples of how you forge this kind of unity in the history of nation-state formations and the work of people like Benedict Anderson or the philosopher Ernest Gellner, the importance of things like newspapers, the media, maps, museums, and bureaucratic pilgrimages all help to forge that consciousness of kind. Simon has raised the issue about the problem of the existential crisis. If we were being really academic, I'd drop in the word ontological crisis as well, yes. But I daren't go there. One might ask, you know, is this just a problem of adolescence, you know, teenagerhood, where we've got this fledgling organization, isn't this inevitable? But he mentions the key problem of a plethora of strategies, but no single strategy. I think the existential problem is the most interesting one. And the question it raises is, what is the EEAS for? And I think earlier panels, we've had indications of why this is a problem, that in a sense, it was created before its purpose had become fully worked out. Maybe a classic example of the assumption that the process of spillover will work through action, create the, you know, if you build it, they will come. If you create it, it will happen. And we've had all sorts of metaphors, but the metaphors are very telling. Yesterday we had the metaphor of the EEAS as like flying a plane while trying to build it. Well, it might help if you have a map as well when you're flying it. La mitrailleuse, this French war machine from Joseph Batura. Well, that's a very, very interesting metaphor. And it reminded me of Lenin and the Bolshevik Party model. And for Lenin, you know, the Bolshevik Party, the metaphor there was this was to be the organizational weapon that would bring about revolutionary change. And then we've had dogs sniffing each other as another kind of interesting metaphor. I don't know where we go with that. But Simon's pointed out the real problem of the composition. And in a sense, you know, these are legacy problems, the perennial problem of how you balance geographical representation. I'm very delighted to see that there's been such a massive change in the gender representation. When I did my study just a few years ago, I think the number of women heads of delegation numbered about 3. So this is a huge increase towards kind of gender mainstreaming of the institution. He's right, Simon, I don't like the word mindset because it implies a rather too rigid and fixed thing, but I do think there is a thing called organizational culture. So to conclude, I mean, you know, I think the first thing to say is it is too early to be lamenting the crisis of identity or the lack of esprit de corps. To use another metaphor, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and to create culture, you do need, we don't have the luxury of a generation, but you do need a fair bit of time. Should the EU be doing more? Well, certainly, yeah, I'm quite amazed that there is so little in the way of training. And training, obviously, seasoned, experienced diplomats don't need to be trained in diplomacy, but they do need to be trained in the ways, the rules of the game of working for the Union. And finally, I do think the idea of a diplomatic service, AMZIC, transitioning to one FÜZIC, I think there are some risks there. You don't want it to become so FÜZIC that it loses its moorings and becomes a service that is really not answerable to anyone but has its own rhyme and reason. But I think at this point, let me throw open the floor for questions. Yes. One, two. Yes.
I say that because I heard a comment from a Swedish person very interested and knowledgeable on foreign affairs recently saying that she had heard someone say that the problem with the EU at the present time is the position of staff, and she thought that was absolutely laughable. What is the importance of that? I mean, it's no importance whatsoever. Well, of course, it's extremely important whether this system works or not. Just being out of the service myself for a year, I think, however, that there is a serious issue of validity of the whole thing. If I look at my own experience, I could be extremely frustrated and across the board negative on the whole setup when I didn't have the answers. What will be my future? What will be the future of my staff? How many posts will I get to my delegation, etc., etc.? Now, I was going out, so it's not a problem. But for many others, the question was, what will happen to me? What will happen to my colleagues? Now, the point is that many, many, many people still are in this situation. They still don't know what will be their future. And I haven't been able to study the papers yet, but I think it's a serious problem of validity. What will be the answers of these and the evaluations of these officials once they have this certainty, what will happen with them, and once they know what will happen with them in the future and with their organizations? That's one problem, validity. The other one is that we know that many departments have not had directors. And in my experience from the past, the directors are absolutely fundamental in creating a corps d'esprit, that those are the senior officials to whom people relate, and you need to be seen by your director. And until just a few weeks ago, in the entire security sphere, for instance, there were enormous vacuums here. So the question of validity is there. We know from the reorganization of the SCR into AIDCO and now into DEVCO that every time you do this, it takes 1.5 years or more before people settle down. And here, in the absence of a reform budget, with just one or two people actually doing the main new thinking here, like Patrick Child and David O'Sullivan and so on, they had enormous difficulties to do this. But in the end, the question about validity, have you checked, you know, to what extent the people themselves felt insecure still about their position, and to what extent there was a correlation between that and their general feeling of negative evaluation. Thank you.
We've got five people queuing up to ask questions. One here, yeah. And then you, and then Brian.
Thank you very much. I'll be brief because I can see David is already fretting. I'm Joëlle Yvonnet. Until the summer, I was posted in Geneva, and I will be talking about my experience this afternoon. And I want to thank you as well for a very interesting presentation. and I want to make a couple of comments. The first one is the very importance of the sense of purpose, actually, that was picked upon by Chris Shaw. I've been working for the European institutions for 20 years, and I feel I have a sense of purpose. You know, I am a European civil servant, and I'm serving the European Union, which is what I've been doing for 20 years. However, in this new configuration, it might not be so obvious to some colleagues how we continue to do that, and you know, for newcomers, how we what the sense of purpose is. But there is something that I think is missing from your presentations, and something that I've heard even yesterday being referred to, and that's the difficulty of working in a multicultural and multilingual environment. And I know that, you know, we have an intake of national diplomats. They're used to working, you know, in multicultural environments. But it is very significantly different, you know, to be working with people of your own nationality, your own culture, where you're developing, you know, you're serving, you know, national interest. And all of a sudden, to be working on a day-by-day basis with people who have different backgrounds, but also their body language is different. And sometimes, I can tell you in a meeting, it can be a little bit disconcerting for some people who are not used to that, and they can actually misinterpret, you know, body language. So this is something that you have not mentioned at all, the difficulty for some national diplomats to adjust to this multicultural and multilingual environment. And maybe if you've got the time, you know, you could pick up on that one as well.
Thank you. It was, yes, you and then Brian?
Thanks. My name is John Henry. I've been providing training in political analysis, political work, and reporting and briefing for the Commission and Council Secretariat, and since it began for the External Action Service with other colleagues. I have two pieces of good news and one piece of bad news to build on the excellent papers presented. One good news is not quite about this subject, but a previous one. That is that £10,000 has been found from the Foreign Office budget to restore Albert the Anaconda, which I think is an encouraging example of the preservation of national treasures. It does raise the question about prioritization in spending, where no money has been found for political and policy training in the Foreign Office since March. Second piece of good news really is to say quite how much is already being done, at least in my little field, of policy and political work for the External Action Service. And I thought it might be helpful if people knew what actually was being delivered, and Simon will know this very well. It's a legacy of what the Commission did for 18 years, I guess, and certainly started by David Spence. In the 5 years leading up to the External Action Service's creation, 200 officials in the Commission and Council Secretariat were being trained a year in policy and political work, recognizing the increasing demands in delegations for that job, even though it wasn't within their remit. That number, so there's more than 2,000 people who have had this training already. That number's now been reduced to about 100 a year, but that's more than almost all member states will have managed in a year. There's 4 or 5 courses a year, only 2 days each, but they're within a package of 5 days of diplomatic training, and typically in each of those courses they're about 2/3 from delegation and 1/3 from headquarters. My team used to be just Brit. It now includes certainly a German and a Dutch senior diplomat in almost all courses. And out of that training, what we discover is that the EAS has created formal templates for reporting and briefing, which look remarkably like those in the UK Foreign Office. But they are increasingly being used, and people are working to them. The whole objective having been clarity, brevity, focus, and especially incorporating political judgment, which until the EAS was created was in many respects formally prohibited or at least discouraged. Each of those courses is attended briefly by the head of the Policy Coordination Unit, Helen Campbell, and she addresses them about what they need at headquarters, and that helps a great deal. And what emerges in discussion with her is 3 key frustrations. The first is the absence of effective vertical communication. It's almost impossible to get through the Berlin Wall of the High Representative's cabinet, and the sense of being in a sense, adrift in what sometimes is referred to as an eccentric culture of management by fear. Second complaint is speed. It's just too slow, too cumbersome. And if that isn't addressed, the EAS will be ignored by the fast-moving foreign services. And thirdly, and really importantly, is the criticism of the imbalance between the political staff at a delegation and the project managers. In most delegations, the only political person may be the head of delegation, or maybe one other, and then there's a big raft of people who have a lot of money to do project management, but nothing on the political side. So those collective uncertainties and worries, you could call socialization by collective moaning, but it generates a sense of we-ness only in the Scottish sense. The bad news, is Simon's already mentioned, and that is that there is no real sense of what the EAS needs in the form of training. There has been no analysis of existing competences and skills and abilities in doing formal diplomatic work. There are no performance measurement criteria, and without those, all you can do to senior managers is to say, training is really important, it's really worthwhile, believe us. Well, if you're going to get some money at any stage, what you need is an empirical foundation that says, here's what we do really well, here's what we would like to do and you want us to do, here are the gaps that are missing, this is the training that is required, and this is what it's going to cost. As soon as you do that, you've got a much better chance of producing a workable training program.
Brian Crowe.
Because this vital socialization function, which is lunch, is but if everyone agrees to have half an hour instead of an hour, then we're on time.
I'm aware we're eating into lunch, so to speak, but I know that there are still we haven't sort of had responses, and there are two more questions, and Brian wants to speak. Can we just hear the questions?
I'll try and be quick. This constant question, which, Chris, you raised again, what is the EAS for, worries me. It's a disparaging question, and it's, in my view, completely the wrong question. The treaty says what the EAS is for. It's to assist the High Representative Vice President in her functions for political work and for the Commission work. So what the EAS does, I think I said in an earlier intervention, is all the work that the Commission used to, Commission delegations used to do, DG RELEX used to do, plus what the Presidency used to do in support of the High Representative VP. That's what the EAS is for. It's the wrong question. But if you ask the right question, then you might get some more interesting answers. The right question is, what is a High Representative VP for? What does she think her job is? Do we really know? What do the member states think her job is? Do we really know? That seems to me a far more important question to ask.
Thank you. Can we get the last question over there, and Eva?
Thank you. Just a quick question, Federica Bicchi from the LSE, very interesting researchers. One question for Simon. You have distinguished between headquarters and delegations, and I was wondering whether you can quickly tell us a little bit more about differences within delegations. How confident are you that, you know, the average you have presented is average in all delegations, or if we go down and zoom in, you know, specific areas are covered in a different way, especially in terms of member states placing their own diplomats in their obvious candidates rather than branching out, because this can obviously have political consequences too.
Okay. Do you want your last question?
A comment on to you, Simon.
Yes.
You very admirably did the women's representation thing. And I did some work on how women entered diplomacy in Norway and how they sort of their numbers increased. Not of particular interest until I stumbled across a very well-researched British inquiry into the same thing by Helen McCloskey. And the interesting thing is that the trajectories are almost identical. What does that tell us? For one thing, it tells us that the democratic practices are imbricated in wider social practices. For another thing, it tells us that diplomacy is not as special as we often think. Except for the usual time lag, it follows the general trends when it comes to things like recruitment of ethnicity and patterns of ethnicity and gender. And third, I think you could make some very interesting predictions and ask some very interesting questions on where this is going in your material from here. And I think we should be optimistic about the answer. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have 5 minutes for quick responses. I'm going to hand over to Carolina first of all.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for all the interesting questions and comments. First of all, the comment of Lars Erik I'd like to address. Well, I agree very much with a lot of what you said. I would maybe just slightly disagree on the question of validity, because when you are researching attitudes and perceptions of staff, you assess them in a certain amount, certain time frame, and that's the result we got. Whereas I would like to tell you that maybe interesting thing is that you said, well, I could be negative because of insecurity. What we found out that in spite of insecurity, people were positive about the project. We wrote another paper of that, trying to explain it through different theoretical lenses and say this has to do with their identities and the way they were pre-socialized before, what they believe in, also self-preselection and issues like that. But we said in spite of this pressure and what in organizational studies they analyzed the whole trauma of 6 stages that the staff goes through in situations like that. And in each stage they say what management of leadership should do. And in spite of that, the attitudes were extremely positive towards the future possible role of the EAS and the European foreign policy. Recently we ran the same survey with the same questions among the national diplomats posted to the council, and you know there is much greater divergence. So I think it's something positive also over there. What Joel said about the sense of purpose and Chris, I totally agree, this is in the heart of our research and extremely important. Just here we focused on, well, what can be done to foster this sense of purpose. And here I think the role of leadership, maybe I didn't emphasize enough, but leadership in terms of outlining the goals of the service, the norms of the service. I've been going on through speeches, a lot of speeches of Catherine Ashton, and at some point she says, well, for me, the EIS is about speaking with one voice, for example, or about coherence and consistency. But there is, I don't know if these are strong enough, you know, norms for the staff to see, well, this is our purpose, to speak with one voice. And in this sense, I would maybe a little bit challenge what Brian Krohn has said. I don't think these questions are totally different. You know, what is the EIS for and what the HR is for. If you see the EIS through the lens of its people, what the HR is for and how she defines her role is in a sense also how she defines the role of her organization, of her staff. Exactly. Exactly. This is what I was trying to mention when I talked of the role of the leader, which is crucial here, to give a sense of direction to the people. And that's what I think was the response was that this is lacking, even from this more positive people. That was quite homogeneous response. If I have a bit of time. I had something else on organizational culture, what you mentioned. Some people would even question that, of course, because they would say in organizations like EIS, for example, could we have organizational culture with all those, one culture, with all those people coming in? And they say this is maybe an appropriate term, we should talk about esprit de corps, exactly because those different organizational culture brought in from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Council, and so on, they mingle together. There is one, not one stable monolithic culture, but you know, but we could still, in spite of those different cultures and different experiences of people, we could still create a common esprit de corps. And what you said, that you saw something different in different delegations, this is where the concept of work group esprit de corps comes in, that in, you can have also, you know, these islands within the service, but the real task is to connect them together. This is what we try to look at, what could be done to somehow, you know, make the links, like communications, like bring them together for common training so they socialize, like these different types of activities. Thank you. Here.
So the last word to Simon.
Yes, I'll just pick up on a few points very briefly because I'm between you and your lunch. I agree with Lars Erik's point about the kind of anxiety within the service about the future, sometimes immediate future, and I think this is part of the newness of the system, and it still has numerous teething problems. For instance, one I've noticed is when staff are returning from delegation, there is enormous difficulty in absorbing them back into the service. And that's why we've seen a proliferation, to be a little bit critical, of advisors and senior advisors. And these are kind of holding jobs, not to be too rude, until this can be really be sorted out. I think there are numerous issues that need to be addressed in recruitment, particularly the compatibility between the services point system and those that exist in the national diplomatic systems. I also note the issues for national diplomats on temporary assignment. We had an interesting discussion yesterday where, if I heard right, it was indicated that the term of service could be 8 years. I know this is what there is provision for, but I'm assuming the normal term of service would be 4 years, the normal rotation. And obviously then the question is, if you do stay longer, are you going to have reintegration problems back into your national diplomatic service? The point, yes, about multiculturalism, the multilingual environment, I couldn't agree more. This is something we should take into account. It is a particularly challenging environment to work in, and I have nothing but admiration for people who work in this environment. But on language, there is an interesting question and research that needs to be done on whether the service staff had the adequate language qualifications for delegation work. And here I refer to a study done by the Polish Institute for International Affairs in 2010, admittedly pre-External Action Service, where they cast doubt on the linguistic abilities of heads of delegations. And I think this needs to be updated. John's points, nothing to add here except just editorially. I think what I find from my perspective is often in the training situation, we are faced with highly mixed groups. To their credit, the service has opened training to other parts of the Commission and the member states, but we find enormous variations in levels and experiences within the same group that naturally makes this extremely challenging. In terms of numbers, you mentioned a few. I've done 15 seminars, events for the service this year, an average of 30 per session to make it interactive. So that's reaching about 450 fonctionnaires a year, which is not bad in terms of impact, as you've indicated. Federica's question on delegations, I don't have the breakdown of the data with me for the individual delegations. Your second point, though, about the member states placing diplomats in the obvious places, there's actually surprisingly little evidence of this. It also depends upon the member state. Spain, for instance, you might have expected to really target Latin America, where they have obvious advantages and skills. But they actually targeted a very broad array of delegations all over the world. I think one obvious mistake that we saw in the first and second rounds of rotation was where the newer member states tended to target those areas that they know best. In other words, Central and Eastern Europe and the CIS. And the result is they didn't get many heads of delegation or even deputy positions in the first and second rounds. Now the problem for them is how to equip themselves with the right knowledge, skill sets, etc., to be able to compete with their counterparts from the older member states for positions on a broad array of locations. Finally, Ivor's very good point on gender. I can concur with what you said, because we are actually trying to extract information from the member states with varying degrees of resistance, I must say, on gender balance within national foreign ministries. And broadly, we are finding from the 13 or 14 samples we already have that we find projected into the service broad trends that you find in national foreign ministries. I would just add on this that I think there are some very useful lessons that we can learn from the member states when in some cases they have implemented very sensible policies for addressing gender-related issues. And here I would mention in passing Denmark and, surprising as it may sound, the FCO as well.
Well, thank you.
thank you. Thank you all for your patience, but a particular thanks for two very stimulating papers from Carolina and Simon. It's time for lunch. Thanks. See you in the next one.